Welcome to the Michigan Writer Series, sponsored by the Libraries, Computing, and Technology. This evening's reading will be from Stuart Dybeck, and to introduce Stuart Dybeck is the English Department's Marcia Aldrich.
Hi, I always wonder about these things where you have introductions for the introducer who introduces the writer who goes on and on and on. And there's a long chain of this, but it gives me great pleasure to introduce Stuart Dybeck. He is quite simply a very well-respected writer, very simply said. He's both a fiction writer and a poet. He has published in both and continues to do so. And if I'm correct, you have two books coming out. One poetry, one fiction. So it goes on. he is also a professor at Western Michigan, where he teaches. And I see you teach visiting places also. And he writes a good deal about the area of Chicago, where he grew up. And I thought, I found an interesting quote in a profile of Stuart by Don Lee in the magazine Plowshares. And this may be a little bit out of date. It was a 1998 profile in which you said that when you began writing, you thought that writing would be about saying something. But later, you changed your mind and said that you think of writing as making something. And using language the way other mediums of art, music in particular, are used so that they lead you to nonverbal places, to something unsayable. And I was going back over reading some of your stories today, and that seemed to me a fairly good description of what you do. Would you change your mind? Would you revise that yet again?
Not yet.
Not yet? Okay. Well, thank you, and let's welcome Stuart Dybeck. Thank you.
I'm just going to read little bits and pieces here and there. Some poems, some stories, maybe for about half an hour. And I'm told that there's a Q&A afterwards. So it's really a pleasure to be here. I haven't read here for quite a while. When I was walking down a street called Delaware, in Chicago, it's one of these wind tunnels that big cities have that seem to amplify the wind off the lake, a wind that in Chicago is called a hawk. And I saw the, there were two Japanese tourists on the corner of Michigan and Delaware, which is where all the Lord and Taylor and the big stores are. And they were trying to take a photograph of their travels. And the wind was blowing so hard that every time the man was about to photograph the woman, some piece of their clothing would blow off and they'd go chasing it down the street. So I offered to take a photo for them, and their English was not very good at all, but at the end of the, they're both holding onto a lamppost, which a stop sign, which was shaking with the vibration of the wind. At the end of the, when I finally took a couple of photos of them, they bowed many times and they kept saying, "Windy City, Windy City." And it was, you know, you could just see they'd read about this place called the Windy City, and they were so pleased because so often places have nothing to do with their nicknames. Windy City. The garments worn and flying dreams were fashioned there. Overcoats that swooped like kites, scarves streaming like vapor trails, gowns ballooning into spinnakers. In a city like that, One might sail through life led by a runaway hat. The young scattered in whatever directions their wild hair pointed, gusting into one another, they fell in love. At night, wind rippled the saxophones that hung like wind chimes in pawn shop windows, hooting through each horn so that the streets seemed haunted, not by nighthawks, but by doves. Pinwheels whirred from steeples in place of crosses. At the pinnacles of public buildings, snagged underclothes, the only flag flapped majestically. And when it came time to disappear, one simply chose a thoroughfare devoid of memory, raised the collar, and turned one's back on the wind. I remember closing my eyes as I stepped into a swirl of scuttling leaves. I thought I'd read a longer poem, I suppose, maybe by way of introduction, called Autobiography. It's divided into 9 short sections. And I, rather than read the numbers, I'll just pause between. Autobiography. Beneath the dripping udders of tar paper roofs, a boy with a stolen jackknife pries winter from spring. That's how I'd begin, with the smell of mud and icicles slipping into rain as widows pass, unbalanced between shopping bags, lugging mysterious griefs by the scruff to novenas. Our Lady of Sorrows, the Black Virgin of Shestohova, was my girlfriend. Once while praying, I saw her smile. Any old woman, palsied with love and terror, I called babushka. No word in English turns a scarf into a grandmother. And every morning was a requiem, or the feast day of a martyr. The priest in black or red, cortege of traffic, headlights funneling through incense under viaducts. While my surplice settled around me like smoke, my father rode the blue spark of a streetcar to the foundry, where in the dark mornings the veins of blackened windows glowed like stained glass. Actually, by noon, the streets were ordinary. Lampposts, sparrows, sewers. But we knew behind the light there were other streets, transfigured by a reverence I can't explain, where hoodlums stood hooded in violet like statues in Lent. The whores were blue from kissing police. There were autobiographies at every corner. Legends, litanies, manifestos, memoirs in forgotten tongues, H, a silent hiss in every tanks. Autobiographies, but no history. By the clang of evening angelus, the babble would condense into a single murmur drone behind a jukebox sax tailing from an open bar. When it rained on 18th Street, I believed that rain was falling all over the world. I believe the neighborhood's war dead were buried beneath the plaque of their names on the corner Victory Garden. And I worried that if people kept dying, the earth would be used up for cemeteries. I worry that if we kept using the same notes over, we'd run out of songs. As one grows up into rebellion, the dead slowly vanish. Later, perhaps they reappear. Sometimes I'd still catch glimpses of that parish of phantoms, that childhood borders, spirits locked in a mazurka with a crucifix, rumors expelled from a confessional, wading a gutter under streetlights as if blood instead of April muck swirled around their black galoshes. I've left out nothing. These images are what I knew. It's not that I didn't listen, but it wasn't my language in matters of sex or money. What might have been told was abandoned like excess baggage. And the commonplace has assumed the mysterious presence of the lost. 9. What I finally remember is feeling free. That's how I'd end, by walking into an epilogue of the present, that republic where allegiance is to dream rather than to tarnished emblems of memory. Its flag of wind waves over an empire alive with the energy required to forget continents. Its citizens united in the mystery of how obliteration becomes liberty. Each step a further separation. My story, another voice receding behind the solo of a saxophone, noodling through broken English. I'm going to read one more poem and then some fiction. I want to read a couple pieces from, I don't know what it is, I guess story in the broadest sense, called Nighthawks. And I'd mentioned Nighthawks in that first poem, Windy City. One of my favorite paintings, and certainly maybe the favorite painting of 20th century Americans, at least in terms of how often it's reproduced on Christmas cards, and is Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. If you don't know it by name, you know it by sight. That corner diner, three people sitting at a counter, little counter man with a white hat on. And I'd seen it so often in reproductions that I had no idea it was at the Chicago Art Institute. And one day, straying from the Impressionists, there it was on the wall. I first thought it must have been some kind of, why don't they have the original here? That is the original. So I wrote this sequence of pieces that started out actually called Nocturnes, but in the writing of it, the title changed to Nighthawks in a kind of a homage to a Hopper. And since writing it, I keep writing these night pieces and keep thinking, gee, if I'd have written that around the time of Nighthawks, I would have just stuck that in there. And this is one of them that I would have stuck in. It's called Journal. In a dream journal, kept as an experiment, evidence of a life that went on without him while he slept, salvaged fragments that might yield revelations about the past or future, he found himself recording nights they spent together. On a page of frozen landscape across which he towed his father, now shrunk into a child, on a sled meant to transport a dead battery, was the August night she'd wiped their sweat with unbound hair. Rowing a turbulent sea of doors, he woke to a tingle of wings, a bat brushing the wind chime in her room, and hovering lips alighting along the length of his body. He was lost on a shore where clarinets were driftwood, and sunrise a camisole slipped from a shoulder. Each time she came, she cried, erect nipples tasting of tears, earlobes familiar with their taste of pearls. The mortgage on his soul was down to a dollar, but where to pay it off? Baby, she said, we're practicing kissing interruptus. To save the world from humankind, a desperate cabal of cetaceans merged the psychic powers of their enormous brains. His handprints still emblazoned on her ass as she stepped into the shower. Prisoners of war assigned to a classroom in which to wait decapitation sat passively at fifth grade desks while he paced wishing for a gun. And when the executioners rushed in, It was another night in which the choice was death or starting from the dream. 3 a.m. He lay listening to her breath, wondering should he gently wake her with his tongue or let her sleep. Scott Fitzgerald writes in Crack Up about a 3 a.m. of the soul. And I think that's what some of these Nighthawks pieces are about, 3 a.m. of the soul. So this is switching from poetry to fiction. And it's a story Nighthawks made up of these various fragments, which are designed to be self-contained as well. So I'm not going to try to give you a sense of, I'm just going to read three fragments from it, rather than the whole, which would take my entire half an hour. Laughter. I knew a girl who laughed in her sleep. She had been in the States only a year, and I wondered if being foreign didn't have something to do with her laughing that way. Her eyes were a gold-flecked green, more suited to cats, and ringed with the longest lashes I'd ever seen. In the right light, her half-lowered lashes threw small shadows across her face. She didn't look American yet. Once I woke her and asked, what was so funny? She seemed confused and a little embarrassed, and I never asked her again. We met at the ice cream factory where I worked the summer between high school and college. She was the first girl I was serious about. I was too young to be serious, a feeling I kept secret. She kept me a secret from her uncle, Tassos. Her uncle was the one who brought her over and got her the job at the ice cream factory. She worked on the bar tank line with the other mostly foreign women, sitting before a conveyor belt and packing popsicles, fudgicles, dreamsicles, and creamsicles into freezer cartons. At the end of the day, her hands were stiff with cold and her fingers stained the colors of whatever flavors had been run. Her uncle Tassos worked on the ore boats out of Calumet Harbor. He would be away on 2-week runs and then off work for 5 days straight. When he was back home, the only place I would get to see her was at the factory. I was still living with my parents and began to feel ashamed for not having my own place to take her. When Uncle Tassos left with the barges again, as safely off somewhere around Petoskey as if he'd sailed for Peloponnesus, she'd sneak me up to her one-room apartment that overlooked Halsted Street. It was an old neighborhood that Mayor Daley, despite his campaign promises, was preparing to demolish to make way for a new university. But life went on that summer as it always had. Daily newspapers printed in strange alphabets, nuts, cheeses, dry cod sold in the streets, the scent of crushed lemons from the bakery that made lemon ice, Greek music skirling from the restaurant downstairs. And once she'd let me in, I wouldn't leave until morning. But sometimes in the middle of the night, I'd have to get up and pace while the dark room filled with laughter. Everything. A couple of months after he'd married Joan, the phone rang in the middle of the night. The phone was in the kitchen and seemed to ring through the dark apartment like an alarm. He had always been afraid of phone calls at that hour. They triggered a dread in him that something terrible had happened, and he almost believed that if he didn't answer, whatever catastrophe had occurred might be undone by morning. But this time he leapt to answer. It was better to get the news firsthand than to listen to his new wife answer the phone and then break into sobs. Hello, he said, trying to sound composed. Yellow, guess who? I know who. Guess what? Give. I'm tripping, an MDA. Oh, ecstasy, you know, the love drug. What's the matter, you don't read Newsweek and keep up? My subscription ran out. It's a body rush, incredibly erotic. I'm so horny, climbing the walls. Nice of you to call and let me know. It heightens memory, too. Hey, I'm still a little nuts about you. Is that Joni flushing the toilet? Yes. She probably wants to know who's on the phone. Exactly right. That's why you're talking to me in that funny flat voice, so quiet, not saying my name. You didn't used to be such a monosyllabic type of guy. Well, at least say something. Like what? Like, what are you wearing? Cute little seersucker jammies? Look, I should hang up. You're supposed to talk people down when they're tripping. I could be in terrible trouble here. Remember that one time we did mushrooms the night you said I turned into Cleopatra? You said it was the pinnacle. We were in college, for Christ's sake. I thought I'd try something like that one more time, you know, like they shout at the end of Basie's April in Paris? One more time! Tribute to the old days. I liked myself better then. Liked you better, too. I don't want to be the one to hang up, okay? You never did. Guess what I'm wearing? Guess how I look on the other end of this telephone line? Listen, I'll rub the phone down my body. See if you can hear. Do you hear anything? No. Well, press your ear against the receiver. You didn't hear that? You didn't hear hair? What part of my body do you think you're talking to right now? Say something soft and breathy. Blow warm air into the phone. Pretend you're a mad breather. It's late. You should go to sleep. Come over. I can't. Baby, come see me. Tell her it's a buddy with a flat tire. I can't. Baby. Oh, baby, 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 baby. I need you so much tonight. Baby, you gotta fix my flat tire. It's 3 a.m. Please, don't make me beg. Come over. We'll do everything. How many other people have you called besides me? Only one. I was going to read one more section from that, but I'm actually, if I do, I'll go over, and I wanted to end with this piece, which is totally different. I even brought a prop for it, so I can't not read it. You guys know what this is? Any of you endure these in music class? I wish I could play a tune on it, but that was an A. Those of you with perfect pitch would have known that. It figures in the story. It's called Field Trips. And it was actually published as an essay in Harper's, but and it is in fact true. Kind of. I don't know if you guys have had this feeling, like, you know, the experiences you've taken for granted all your life that were just normal, and you're sitting around with a bunch of people having drinks and talking, and somebody says, "No way." Yeah, it just happened. No, that didn't happen. Yeah, it happened. Then you begin wondering, well, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe my mind is just so strange I made that up. No, it happened. Of course, you don't know what I'm talking about till I read the story. We took two field trips in grade school. The first was a tour of the Bridewell House of Corrections and the Cook County Jail. The prison complex was on 26th and California, only blocks away from St. Roman's School, so herded by nuns into an orderly column, with the girls in front and the boys bringing up the rear, our fifth grade class walked there. The nuns must have thought it was a perfect choice for a field trip, as not only was there a suitable cautionary lesson to be learned, but it saved on bus fare, too. Filing from school at mid-morning felt like a jailbreak. Paired up with pals, we traipsed down California, gaping like tourists at the familiar street coming to life. Delivery trucks double parking before greasy spoons, open doors revealing the dark interiors of bars, still exhaling boozy breath from the night before. Some of the kids, like bad Brad Norkey, already twice convicted of stealing the class milk money, were hoping to see various relatives who were doing time at the county. Others, like my best friend Rafael Mendoza, were hoping to catch a glimpse of a mob boss or a mass murderer or the infamous psychopath Edward Gein, a farmer from the wilds of Illinois who supposedly cannibalized his victims and tanned their skins to make lampshades and clothes. Guin fascinated us. Some years later, when I was in high school, I bought a pair of hand-stitched moccasin-top gray suede shoes that, when soaked with rain, turned a cadaverous shade. And my buddies took to calling them my Guin shoes. That, in turn, developed into a neighborhood expression of appreciation for any article of clothing that looked sharp in an unconventional way. Muy Guin man, or Guin cool. At the same time, the term could also be used as an insult. Your mama's a Guin. Even more of a draw than the murderers and celebrity psychos at County, at least for the boys, was the promise of getting a look at the electric chair. We'd heard it was kept in the basement. Local legend had it that a sudden burst of static on the radio or a blinking TV reception, say during the Howdy Doody show, meant they just fried someone at County. We thought maybe we'd get to shake the hand of the warden or whoever flipped the switch at executions, but if an electric chair was there at all, we never got to see it. Surprisingly, the most memorable part of the trip occurred not at County, where the men, pinned in what the tour guide informed us were 60 square foot cells, mostly ignored us, but rather at Bridewell when they took us through the women's wing. The inmates there, prostitutes mainly, saw the nuns and made some comments about being brides of Christ that truly were educational. "Yo, sister, what kind of meat do the Pope eat on Friday?" "None." "Hey, Sister Mary Hyman, when I dress up like that, I get an extra 50. The nuns didn't respond, but their faces assumed the same impassive, inwardly suffering expressions that the statues of martyrs wore, and they began to hurry us through the rest of the tour. A hefty female guard rapped the bars with her stick and shouted, "Pipe down, Taffy, there's kids for God's sakes." And Taffy laughed. "She it, Bull Moose. When I was their age, I was doing my daddy." And from another cell, someone called, "Amen, girl." The next year, the nuns avoided the jail and instead took us to the stockyards, a trip that required a bus. A rented yellow school bus was already waiting when we got to school that morning. We filed on, boys sitting on the left side of the aisle and girls on the right. I sat next to a new kid, Joseph Bonomo. Usually new kids were quiet and withdrawn, but Bonomo, who'd only been at St. Roman for a couple weeks, was already the most popular boy in class. Everyone called him Joey B. His father had been a Marine lifer, and Joey B was used to moving around, he said. He moved around so much that he was a grade behind, a year older than everyone else, but he didn't seem ashamed of it. He was a good athlete, and all the girls had crushes on him. That included Sylvie Perez, who over the summer had suddenly, to use my mother's word, developed. Exploded into bloom was closer to the truth. Along with the rest of the boys, I pretended as best I could not to notice. It was too intimidating to those of us who'd been her classmates for years, but not to Joey B. "Like my old man says, tits that size have a mind of their own," he confided to me on the way to the yards. "And hers are thinking, feel me up, Joey B." "How do you know?" His hand dropped down and he clutched his crotch. Telepathy. "Class," Sister Bull Moose asked, "do you know our tradition when riding a bus on a field trip?" "A round pound," Joey B whispered to me. No one raised a hand. We didn't know we had a tradition. As far as we knew, we were the first class from St. Roman ever to take a bus on a field trip. Sister Bull Moose's real name was Sister Amabilia, but she had a heft to her that meant business, and she wielded the baton she used to conduct choir practice, not unlike the guard we'd seen wielding a nightstick at Bridewell a year before, so my friend Raphael had come up with the nickname. From within her habit, a garment that appeared to have infinite storage capacity, she produced the pitch pipe, also used in choir practice, and sustained a note. "Girls start, and boys come in on merrily, merrily, merrily." Joey B sang in my ear, "Row, row, row your boner." At the yards, there was a regular tour. First stop was the armor packing plant, where meat was processed into bacon and sausage. I think the entire class was relieved that the smell wasn't as bad as we worried it might be. We knew we had traveled to the source of what in the neighborhood was called the brown wind or the glue PU factory, a stench that settled over the south side of Chicago at least once a week. My father said it was the smell of boiling hooves, hair, and bone rendered to make soap. I once dissected a bar of ivory on which I'd noticed what appeared to be animal hair to see if there were also fragments of bone beneath. We left the processing plant for the slaughterhouse and from a metal catwalk looked upon the scene below where workmen wearing yellow hard hats and white coats smeared with gore heaved sledgehammers down on the skulls of steers that, urged by electric prods, filed obediently through wooden chutes. Every time the hammer connected, my friend Raphael would go, kaboom. That has the smart, Joey B. said. For the finale, they took us to where the hogs were slaughtered. A man with hairy, thick, spattered forearms, wearing rubber boots and a black rubber apron, shiny with blood, stood holding a butcher knife before a vat of water. An assembly line of huge, squealing hogs suspended by their hind legs swung past him, and as each hog went by, the line would pause long enough for the man to slit the hog's throat. He did it with a practiced, effortless motion, and I wondered how long he'd had the job, what it had been like on his first day, and if it was a job I could ever be desperate enough to do. Up to then, my idea of the worst job one could have was bus driver. I didn't think I could drive through rush hour traffic down the same street over and over while making changes bus drivers had to do in those days. But watching the man kill hogs, I began to think that driving a bus might not be so bad. With each hog, there was the same terrified squeal, but louder than a squeal, more like a shriek that became a grunting gurgle of blood. A Niagara of blood splashed to the tile and into a flowing gutter of water where it rushed, frothing away. The man would plunge the knife into the vat of water before him, and the water clouded pink. Then he'd withdraw the shining blade just as the next squealing hog arrived. Meanwhile, the hogs who just cranked by, still alive, their mouths, nostrils, and slit throats pumping dark red gouts, were swung into a bundle of hanging bodies to bleed. Each new carcass slammed into the others, causing a few weak squeals and a fresh gush of blood. The tour guide apologized that we couldn't see the sheep slaughtered. He said that some people thought the sheep sounded human, like children, and that bothered some people, so they didn't include it on the tour. It made me wonder who killed the sheep. We'd seen the men with sledgehammers and the man with a knife. How were the sheep slaughtered? Was it a promotion to work with the sheep, something they sent only the most expert slaughterers to do? Or was it a job that nobody in the yards wanted? Just like the goddamn electric chair, Raphael complained. How's that, Joey B. asked. They wouldn't let us see the chair when we went to the jail last year either. At the end of the tour, on our way out of the processing plant, they gave each of us a souvenir hot dog. Not a hot dog Chicago style, poppy seed bun, mustard, never ketchup, onion, relish, tomato, pickles, pepper, celery, salt. This was a cold hot dog, wrapped in a napkin. We hadn't had lunch and everyone was starving. We rode back on the bus eating our hot dog, singing Frère Jacques. I was sitting by the window, Joey B. beside me, and right across the aisle from him, no accident, probably, was Sylvie Perez. I realized it was a great opportunity, but I could never think of anything to say to girls in a situation like that. Sylvie, Joey said, you liking that hot dog? It's okay, Sylvie said. You look good eating it, he told her. It sounded like the stupidest thing I'd ever heard, but all she did was blush, smile at him, and take another demure nibble. I knew it was against the rules, but I cracked the opened the window of the bus and tried to flick my balled-out hot dog napkin into a passing convertible. Sister Bullmoose saw me do it. Why does there always have to be one who's not mature enough to take on trips, she asked rhetorically. For punishment, I had to give up my seat and stand in the aisle, which I did to an indifference on the part of Sylvie Perez that was the worst kind of scorn. Since you obviously need special attention, Stuart, you can sing us around, Sister said. Once during our weekly music hour, looking in my direction, she inquired, who is singing like an off-key foghorn? When I'd shut up, still moving my mouth, but only pretending to sing, she'd said, that's better. I don't know the words, I said. Oh, I think you do. Dormez-vous, bim-bam-boon. They're easy. Joey B. patted the now empty seat behind him as if to say to Sylvie, now you can sit here. Sylvie rolled her pretty eyes toward Sister Bullmoose and smiled. Joey B. nodded that he understood and smiled back. And they rode like that in silence, communicating telepathically while I sang. And that's as far as I'm going to read. Thank you. The Q&A things, I won't take much time, but if you have a couple of questions, I'd be happy to try to answer. I don't want to discourage you from asking. The novel and stories, which comes out in November, is called I Sailed with Magellan, a historical novel based on my experience of... It's actually a song one of the kids in the novel sings at night to go to sleep by. And the book of poems, all of the poems I read tonight were from that book. None of the fiction I read tonight was from I Sail from with Magellan. It's called Streets in Their Own Ink. Any other questions? Yeah, it's a short. It actually was first published as a poem. Yeah, and I've taken to padding my resume by then taking my poems and putting them in a prose. if you're working in a department that pays for you know, publisher parish, I highly suggest. It's hard with a haiku. Old frog jump and plop. That's not much of a... But if you go a little longer... No, I never liked it as a poem, so I reworked it into this short show. That actually appeared in the book that I was reading from tonight, which is called The Coast of Chicago, which is out of print and comes back into print in the fall. So... It was. Judith Kitchenette edited that book and, in short, purported to be very short essays. Why she stuck that in there, I have no idea, because it was published as fiction. But, I mean, those categories seem to me to be academic so often. And in fact, one of the things that I find entertaining if not sometimes fascinating, is the notion of playing around with categories and trying to ignore them and, make hybrids between them and so on and so forth. And I'm not disputing the fact that there are long traditions in poetry and fiction and so on and so forth that are and should be honored, but you can also take a lot of liberties with these things. So... I was telling Michael earlier that a good friend, a writer from Detroit, published a collection that reported to be interviews with lawyers, which is assigned in law school and studied in, you know, the Columbia Law Journal did an entire issue on this book. I know he made them all up. And in Germany, it was published as a novel. And I mean, my feeling isn't that he's pulling the wool over anybody's eyes. My idea is that, you know, I mean, if you're, do we have to adhere so strongly to these categories when it's appropriate not to? I mean, obviously, if somebody is writing something in which they claim is an actual interview with identifiable subjects, that's different. But he never identified these characters. Going back to this conversation I just had earlier with Michael, we talked a little bit about writing about religion as a subject, and you know, just to repeat myself, that there's a lot you can say about it, and what fascinates me about it is the relationship between religion and culture, so that writing about religion can also be writing about whatever your culture is. You know, in the case of my stories, either Polish-American or Hispanic, which were both strong elements in the neighborhood I grew up in. But, you know, clearly the model of all the wonderful Jewish-American writers and Roth and Bellow and so on and so forth, it can be done with any religion. The other thing is that religion affords us a vocabulary to express mystery. And I used to like to say the word awe, but ever since the latest, what was the great phrase that we... it's painful for me to trot that word out anymore. But in any case, you know, often what seems as if a writer is writing about Catholicism or Judaism or Islam or whatever it is, really what the writer is writing about is mystery. And that sense so a lot of what goes on in my work, I think, falls into those two categories. I'm not particular. I mean, I'm certainly not either espousing or and as in this story, you could use it for comic effect. And I must say, you know, making fun of nuns, it's cheap. It's a cheap joke. And really, it's. I think I have actually a little more complex attitude toward it than that story lets on. But it's from the point of view, the heartless point of view, of a kid. But I mean, it just struck me at some point, too late to modify my behavior anymore. That, you know, these were working class women, who, like a lot of working class people, joined the clergy or joined other kinds of things in order to get an education, and they were living out the sometimes very admirably the boundaries of the lives they found themselves born into, and someday I'd actually like to write a little bit more compassionately about it. But on the other hand, they're funny too, you know. Another, yeah. I don't think it's any different than anybody else's, which is that you discover when you're writing prose, you have to do it all the time. And, you know, the old truism about lyric poetry is, what do you do with the other 23 and a half hours of the day? And I mean, that's been kind of true for me. That is that it isn't that I work less on poetry. It's just that And there's a relationship I've never ever been able to really figure out for myself, for me, personally, between my poetry and my fiction. If I didn't write poetry, and Ray Carver said the same thing, by the way. Ray said I couldn't write fiction if I didn't write poetry. And that's really true for me. Poetry is kind of the first take I have on everything. And I keep journals in verse. I mean, it just comes out that way. It isn't, and collect images. And then I loot that stuff. And a lot of my stories actually, like Confession, did start out as poems. Quite a few of them. And in not being able to resolve them as poems, I was able to resolve them as stories. And so in terms of writing every day and so on and so forth, I'm just as typical as just about any other writer you talk to. In terms of that connection between poetry and fiction, you know, for some writers that's more important than others. Is there one more question and then we'll call it quits? Yeah. No, there's all kinds of reasons for it. First and foremost is the frustration of not having had the talent. So then instead of standing here reading words, I would so much prefer to be playing you guys a tune, or playing somebody a tune. And music was, and I think for a lot of people it's true, because it's a popular art, for a lot of young people, I think it's sometimes the first art they take really seriously. And it certainly was true for me. And it opened up every other door for me. I read because of music. I changed attitudes I grew up with in this working class neighborhood because of music. You know, I mean, all kinds of prejudice and that you pick up on the street, music gave the lie to. So there's that. And then I write to music all the time, which I guess goes back to the other question that you'd asked. It's kind of creates a soundtrack that I then try to find words for, and I listen to it incessantly. And actually, it's a huge theme in this I Sailed with Magellan book. It's every story has a song in it. The overall title of the book is the title of a song that occurs in one of the stories. A lot of the characters are identified through the songs they sing. So trying to make things coherent, going back to the subject of religion, music is in fact what I have for religion. You know, it's the closest to being, in its spell, I'm the closest to being in a meditative state. It's universal language, the way it crosses boundaries of language and boundaries of time, gives to the listener that sense of oneness that many religions are about. So all those things are in music. And finally, it's going back to the very kind introduction. It gives the example of how you can communicate without language. And so it's impossible to do that in words. It's a paradox, but it's a paradox that I'm fond of playing around with. So, long answer, sorry. Anyway, thank you very, very much.